and it doesn't cause certain jobs to be born. Now, there are other laws and regulations that handicap people. One that I've just done a lot of research on, and some of it's cited in my book that Chris Thames says is on sale here. You should buy many copies and give to your friends. All in your social interest. But occupational and business licensing laws. In the United States, one that I talked about is the taxicab industry, where one, in order to own and operate a taxi in New York City, you have to go out and buy a $65,000 license. In Chicago, it's $40,000. In Miami, $35,000. In Philadelphia, my city, it's $20,000 down from $33,000. Now, you ask yourself, well, what is the effect of a law that generates a $65,000 license price? Well, that law tends to discriminate against poor people getting in the cab business, because poor people don't usually have $65,000 laying around, nor do they have bank credit that will enable them to get a $65,000 loan. Now, in some of these cities, blacks own very few of the cabs. In Philadelphia, blacks own 3% of the taxis, and Philadelphia is a city that's 40% black. But if you go to Washington, D.C., it turns out that 70 to 80% of the taxis in Washington, D.C. are owned by blacks. And you might say, well, why does this guy say, you know, how come he can't be more precise since he's a professor? How come he can't come up and say 76%? Well, it turns out that when my research assistant and I were doing the study, we went to the files, and we could tell race by the pictures, because the pictures were next to the licenses in Washington, and some of the guys looked kind of shaky. We could tell definitely that 70% of them were black, but some of them had some mixed ancestry, and so we weren't that sure, so we used a little fudge factor. But you say, well, how come they have, you know, how come so many blacks own taxis in Washington, D.C., as opposed to other cities? Do you say, according to the racial discrimination hypothesis, well, there's no racial discrimination in Washington? That's what explains it. No, that doesn't explain it at all. It turns out in Washington, D.C., that the license to own and operate a taxi is under $100, and $100 differs significantly from $65,000. Furthermore, as a result of having an open market in Washington, D.C., many people benefit. But as Washington has the highest quality cab service of any city in the United States, if you measure quality by the number of taxis per 1,000 of the population, it has 12.1 taxis per 1,000 population. New York has 2.4 taxis per 1,000 population. Philadelphia has a third of a taxi per 1,000 population. Furthermore, in Washington, D.C., taxi prices are among the lowest in the United States. Now, but I might mention, just as a conclusion to things I'm going to say about taxis, is that you shouldn't think of licensing necessarily as a racial phenomenon, even though it may have some racial aspects, because while I was doing the study of the taxicab industry, when I jumped in the cab, I would try to get some anecdotal stuff, and I'd strike up a conversation with the driver. And one time I landed at D.C. National Airport, and a black driver picked me up, and I said to him, gee, you guys are lucky in Washington, D.C. You don't have to go out and buy a $65,000 license in order to be in business. And he said to me, well, we've been trying to get the medallion system or licensing system here, but Congress won't go along with it. And Congress controls Washington, D.C. And so he said to me, he says, as it is, you know, it's so cheap to get into business that we have these damn Pakistanis coming in and the West Indians and the Arabs and everybody else honing in on our business. So I say that to point out to you that it's not an issue of race. It's more of an issue of the ins versus the outs. And the ins want a mechanism to keep the outs out so that they can charge us higher prices and earn higher income and higher wages and higher profits. So it's not... So if you're trying to deregulate the cab industry, let's say in London, you wouldn't try to organize any black cab drivers. I'm not talking about the... black racially. Or you wouldn't want to organize the minority cab drivers, because they're in and they have the same vested interest as the as white drivers. That is, everybody likes monopoly. And monopoly is okay, so long as you don't use government to enforce monopoly, in my opinion. I mean, everybody likes monopoly, because that's what marriage is, isn't it? I mean, that's the marriage license is monopoly. And, you know, like a lot of people say to me, and I look at them, they say, gee, he wasn't like that before we got married. He was open car doors. Well, of course he was a little more efficient because he was competing. But once you get married, I mean, once you get married, there's less competition, supposedly, anyway. And so you run into all kinds of inefficiencies associated with monopoly. But people have the right to form those kind of monopolies so long as they volunteer, in my opinion. But let me just kind of finish up, because I'm sure there's some questions. I don't want to outdo my time. In the United States, there are roughly 900 licensing laws, licensing 900 different occupations. And there are well over 3,000 licensing jurisdictions. And they license things from cosmetology to barbering, landscaping, lightning rod installers, auctioneers, fortune tellers, etc., etc., which is not to exclude things like doctors, lawyers, architects, electricians, plumbers, etc., etc. Now, the basic effect of these licensing laws is that of excluding entry and making it possible for those who are already in to charge higher prices and earn higher income. A lot of the licensing in the United States indeed was racially motivated. That is, many people do not realize, despite the fact that blacks have a lot of trouble entering the trade constructions right now in the United States, at one time, particularly in the southern United States, blacks dominated the skilled trades such as bricklayers, carpenters, stonemasons, etc., etc., and plumbing. And if you read through some of the licensing laws and some of the legislative debate behind some of the licensing laws, most notably in the South, United States, the stated intention of those laws was to get rid of blacks. That is, the whites just could not compete with the cheaper labor services. And blacks did a lot of the construction in the South. The whole cities were built by blacks, particularly during the Reconstruction period. There were 8 schools and the Market Center in Washington, D.C., and other important buildings that were built by blacks under black supervision. So how do you explain the fact that blacks aren't very well represented in many trades today? Is it because, well, blacks just go, hey, I'm tired of being a carpenter and just quit en masse? No, it was licensing laws that eliminated them from the trade. So, again, it's rules of the game that determine the outcome of the game. And let me just say a few more things.
Do I have about 5 minutes?
A few more things that I think I should say, and this is kind of a little bit disorderly here, but if I don't say them to you, if I don't tell you, you'll just go through the rest of your life not knowing them, and I feel somewhat obligated. A good deal of the problem that we face as people, as human beings in general, indeed has to do with race and sex. Because I think that black people, or racial minorities, if you want to use that terminology, and women are used as cannon fodder for those who want more state control. Because after all, when people argue for more government control, what are they saying? They're saying, well, we need to help the blacks. We're doing this. We're going to control rents because we want to help blacks. We want a minimum wage law because we want to help blacks. We want equal pay for equal work laws because we want to help women, et cetera, et cetera. And what they really want to do, they want to help themselves. But they're using some of the problems of women and the problems of minorities as entry points to get greater control over our lives. And I think that as libertarians, we need to debunk a lot of the mythology that's used to further these people's ends. Because after all, I believe that most human beings are decent people, and that they are indeed concerned about the problems that blacks or women might face, and they fall easy prey to charlatans and quacks offering these solutions. I think part of the problem has to do with the terminology that we even use, and I just want to comment on I don't want us to use the language of our enemy. That is, we have confusing terminology. Like they say, well, we want more government intervention to integrate the schools or to end segregation in schools. Well, a word like segregation, so far as schools in the United States today, is inappropriately applied. And because what people do, they shift the definitions of terms when they go to one subject to another. Let me give you just a brief explanation. If I were to ask the average American, or ask the average Londoner, or average Briton, are the water fountains at the D.C., Washington, D.C. National Airport, had they been desegregated? Yeah, at one time, blacks weren't not allowed to drink from water fountains in certain places. I say, well, had they been desegregated? I'm quite sure that the average American would say, yes, they have been desegregated. And what would be the test that they would use to determine whether they've been desegregated? They'd just go to the airport and see whether a black, if he were in an airport, could drink from the water fountain. But when you ask the question, have schools been desegregated in the United States? Well, you get a lot of controversy over that. Some people say, yes, they have been desegregated, and some people say, no, they're still segregated. And they want a lot of Supreme Court busing and things like that to desegregate the schools. Well, look what happens to the meaning of segregation and desegregation when you switch from water fountains to school. That is, nobody in their right mind, when you ask them, have the water fountains at D.C. National Airport, have them been desegregated? Nobody in their right mind says, well, look, blacks are 70% of the population of Washington, D.C., or 70% of the people drinking at the water fountains at any time, are they black? And if not, then the water fountains are segregated. Now, but however, they do that with respect to schools. They say, well, blacks are 12% of the population somewhere, and if the school does not have 12% black, then it is segregated, and we need to have busing. Now, they give an operational definition to segregation and desegregation when we're talking about water fountains, and they use a non-operational definition when we talk about schools. They're talking about racial balance and things like this. And because of the sloppy terminology, people come up with sloppy policy. Because nobody in their right mind, you know, and you know, it's probably, yeah, I guess when I walked to D.C. National Airport, that only 15% of the people drinking water at the fountain are black, despite the fact that D.C. is a city of 70% blacks. Now, having observed that, nobody in their right mind would propose busing. That is, to bus whites from the airport fountains out to Anacostia and bus the blacks from Anacostia out to the D.C. National Airport. But people do that in schools because they use sloppy definitions. I doubt whether in the United States where you can find one public school that does not admit people on racial criteria. Or if there is one, it's just very few. Then let me just finally give one other definition, because I don't really have a nice, very nice conclusion because I'm going over time, but people say, they use the term prejudice, that prejudice is a problem. Well, I think prejudice is a very, very good word to use when we talk about human relationships, but we use it incorrectly. Now, when people talk about prejudice, they're saying, well, prejudice represents you don't like somebody, or things like this, or you use stereotypes. Well, I say, what's wrong with using stereotypes? I think stereotypes are very good. They convey information. You know, for example, now some of you might say, well, look, you might say, I'm not prejudiced, but you either are prejudiced or you're a fool. Now, when I talk about prejudice, I use this Latin derivative. That means to make decisions on the basis of incomplete information. That is, you prejudge things. You don't wait to get all the information in before you make a decision. And an economist can best understand prejudice as those decisions made on the basis of incomplete information. Now, for example, suppose we're getting ready to break in a few minutes, but suppose as you're walking out the back door of this room, as you turn the corner, you see a full-grown lion sitting there. What would you do? Most people, I would predict, it's an uninteresting prediction, would seek to leave the area in great dispatch, wouldn't you? Well, why? Is your decision run based on any detailed information about that particular tiger? Or is it based on tiger folklore? what your friends have told you about tigers, how you've seen other tigers behave. You are prejudging that tiger, aren't you? Now, of course, if you were not prejudiced, you would attempt to get some more information about that tiger before you ran. You would come up there and pet him on the to establish whether he's dangerous. You know, here, kitty, kitty, and struggling. And then, and only then, if he behaved in a menacing fashion, would you run. But see, most people, they, when they see the tiger there, they make a quick or an instantaneous cost-benefit analysis. They say, they conclude that the cost of an additional unit of information about that tiger far exceeds the benefit. And so they don't search anymore. Now, so you, the use of stereotypes and prejudice is a very, very important part of the optimal stock of human decision-making techniques. Now, the same thing with sexual stereotypes. If I'm going to, you know, the guy say, hey, Williams, among this group of nice libertarians, pick a five-person basketball team, and if you win, well, you'll get $1 million. Well, I mean, I like women. As a matter of fact, some of my best friends are women. But I would not pick any of the females here because I guess, I prejudge them as not as being good, not being as good in basketball. Although, you could have the Olympic team here that I just don't know of, but on the average, I'm right. Now, so what I'm saying is that prejudging or stereotypes, and this also applies to employment, applies to interest lending, et cetera, people use these techniques, is, I believe the concept of prejudice as a, is misled, I mean, is not defined very well, and we shift our meanings on it, and we should have, at least in our own minds when we talk about people, we should recognize that these words or these terms are being used inconsistently and perhaps mischievously. Okay, so in conclusion, before you raise some questions, I think that the problems that minorities face is a problem of government intervention. And I believe if, as Ronald Reagan says, which he has not done, if government were off our backs, I think we'd have a much better society, and I think that minorities would find greater upward mobility. Thank you very much.
Well, we might be near to Greenwich, but that doesn't mean that we should use Greenwich Mean Time. I think we'll use Libertarian Mean Time, which has tended to be somewhat behind Greenwich Mean Time on account, I believe, of the fact that we're west of Greenwich right here, and that makes a lot of sense. So there is time, or I declare using my chairman's prerogative that there's time for discussion and questions, and but before doing so, I want to use another chairman's prerogative, and that's make another point that is interesting here. In recent years, there have been reforms in South Africa in terms of which blacks are now allowed to enter business freely in so-called black areas in Soweto. And within 3 years of being permitted to do that, the Soweto Chamber of Commerce and the National Black Chamber of Commerce is now the most powerful lobby in South Africa for maintaining separate racial group areas in order to keep white traders out of black areas. So that it is conspicuously not a case of race, but a case of insiders and outsiders, or of getting in and slamming the door behind you, and this is happening all over the show. Anyway, one here and then at the back, then Brian and then Dean.
Oh.
In fact, might I ask Walter if you'll just stand here and field the questions yourself?
In the United States, there's one case that has been puzzling me. In the nursing profession, seems to be low paid, and yet they're always crying about a shortage. And have you looked into that for any kind of explanation?
The question for those of you did not hear, in the nursing profession, it appeared to be low paid, and there are always talking about shortages. I think that if you're talking about practical nurses, they have recently, over the last 10 years being recent, they've been licensed in the United States, and the licensing has cut off the supply of many people. I'm personally aware of one particular case. My wife's sister was a practical nurse for something like 25 years, and then licensing was introduced, and she did not have the education. She didn't graduate from high school. She did not have the education to pass the licensing test. And so her doctor came to her, told her one day she just could not work as a practical nurse anymore. And so now she works as a lab technician, counting and making blood counts and things like this. But she was effectively excluded from being a practical nurse. And I imagine many other people of similar backgrounds were excluded from the field of practical nurse by nursing by the licensing laws. What's that?
Yeah. This explains the shortage, but how does that explain the low wages? I think there must be some other kind of intervention causing the low wages.
Okay, well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether, low wages, we can't speak absolutely. I don't know about the wage structure, but relative to their other alternatives, I think that if I have my numbers right, that practical nurses at least make around $16,000 to $17,000 a year, and the fully licensed registered nurse who's an OR, operating room nurse, you're talking about somebody in their 30s, $30,000. So I'm not quite sure what that means as a wage relative to their other alternatives. I don't know whether that's low or high. Leon wants.
Yeah, we must adjourn now, otherwise we won't have coffee. There is discussion later of Walter's paper, the two Walters, Walter Block after coffee. So I'm going to use the further chairman's prerogative and not proceed with questions. But what it remains then for me just to thank Walter Williams for what has been one of the most entertaining, thought-provoking, and challenging of the papers we've had here. And let me mention, to give you some suggestions as to how to deal with some kinds of prejudice. And that is, I now routinely in South Africa, where forms require me to put my race, which they don't require of Washington taxi cab drivers, so Walter had to look at their pictures. If it says race, I put human. And there are a couple of other nice libertarian answers on official forms. One of them is if it asks if you want to have dependents, for example, I put 1 million pensioners, 300,000 civil servants. And then finally, when I came into the UK, it says their purpose of visit, and I routinely put that the purpose of everything I do is to restore the Habsburgs in Austria. And I think we libertarians need to have some creative form-filling in approaches, which gradually will undermine the bureaucracy. But now I learned some of these techniques from Walter, and if you do have the opportunity to talk to him later, ask him about his approach, for example, to military service, and you'll find that it's creative and very libertarian and very effective. Let's thank him again in the appropriate way for an outstanding presentation.